accession number 8337, reel 6.
General Graham, reel 6.
Why the Omanis are different to the other inhabitants of the Arabian Peninsula? Firstly, of course, Oman has been an independent country in its own right for centuries. It was occupied briefly and in part by the Portuguese and by others. All these people got chased out in turn. Unlike the Trucial states, it was never a British protectorate. It was an independent state with treaty relations dating from, I think, 1798 with England. Furthermore, of course, Oman was never occupied by the Turks. It was never part of the Ottoman Empire. And I believe that this continual freedom from either an occupying power or from being a vassal state of a country such as France or England or Holland has assisted them in this feeling of dignity and pride which they so obviously have and deserve to have.
Now, can you tell me what Britain's role in Oman was at the time?
Yes. Well, as I mentioned, from the time of the Napoleonic War, Britain had had an interest in Oman, and this interest stemmed very largely from the need, our need to secure our trade routes to India and the Far East and make certain that we got certain facilities such as coaling stations later on, and the French did not. Our permanent military interest in Oman really started with the events in the 1950s. An area of Bahraimi, an area called Bahraimi, which is in Oman, an important oasis, was occupied illegally by Saudi forces, and Britain played some part in supporting Oman in eventually getting the Saudis ejected, not by military means, by political means. Some years later, there developed yet again a clash between the religious rulers of the interior of Oman, based on Nizwa, on the Jebel Akta area, and the Sultan himself, who tended to reside in and hold sway over the inhabitants of the coastal plain and the south. And these clashes came to a head in 1958 when there was a major uprising supported by the Saudis in which the Sultan's forces were routed by the insurgents in the general area of Nizwa, Firk, and the foothills of the Jebel Akta. Now, the Sultan's forces at that time did include a small number of British ex-officers and NCOs there on contract, and one or two are still there to this day. And these individuals have played a most major part in creating and leading the Sultan's armed forces, and in fact, keeping a degree of stability within the Sultanate. But these small forces under their direction were routed. And to restore the situation, the British government sent in the Cameronians from Kenya and, at a later stage, two squadrons of the Special Air Service Regiment from the Far East. And this was during a campaign known as the Jebel Akta campaign, which took place in 1958 and 1959, which ended with the the defeat of the insurgents, the fleeing abroad of the insurgent leaders, and the restoration, fairly happily and smoothly, of the power of the Sultan. The Sultan at that time was Sultan Said bin Taimur, a most charming old man. But, of course, it was perfectly apparent that if the Sultan's forces remained on their original footing, that is to say with a handful of contract and not very experienced British officers at their head, that the same situation could well break out again in years to come. Therefore, letters of agreement were drawn up between Her Majesty's government in London and the Sultan, by which a certain number of British serving officers should be seconded to take over the highest positions in the Sultan's armed forces, to enable the Sultan to continue to recruit contract officers for the less senior appointments from Britain, and that I think that a small sum of money, I think it was something in the order of £1 million a year sterling, would be paid by London to the Sultan to help him to equip and train these forces. And the Sultan's armed forces, as we know them today, really stem from those forces which came out of that agreement.
And so what was your own personal role going to be in 1970?
When I arrived as the commander of the Sultan's armed forces, I was exactly what the word said, the commander of all the Sultan's armed forces. That is to say, the land forces, the air force, and the navy. Now, that all sounds very grand, but in practical terms, in March 1970, the total force consisted of rather less than 4,000 all ranks. The army was the biggest component. And the other ranks in it were Baluch rather than Arabs. The artillery battery was solely manned by Baluch other ranks. There were three infantry battalions and a gendarmerie force. And that is about all. All the officers were British. There were, in fact, Omanis and Baluch dressed up as officers, as subalterns. They weren't permitted to hold a rank higher than lieutenant, and presumably because he was feared that sooner or later one of these people might attempt to seize power, the Sultan had forbidden these Arab or Baluch officers to receive any military training or military education to fit them for those ranks. They were, in fact, very good, brave sergeants promoted to the rank of officer, but without the qualifications to be officers. But that was not their fault. It was a sultanic decree.
Because of fear of a coup. So was it the Sultan who put the bar on them rising above a lieutenant?
Oh, entirely. Oh, entirely, Sultan. Entirely. The next component of any significance was the Air Force. The Air Force, for obvious reasons, was entirely British manned. It was very small. We only have 11 aircraft. And they were jet strike masters, which had cannon and were capable of dropping two bombs of 500 pounds, I think. We had a small number of Beaver aircraft, which could carry, I think, three passengers. And we had two very aged Dakotas, one of whom, I'm told, had been President Eisenhower's at one stage. And that was all. The Navy consisted of two armed dhows, wooden vessels with sails and an engine, with machine guns mounted. They were commanded, the two of them, by a very splendid chap called Jeremy Raybould.
Who?
Jeremy Raybould. Now, for a country with a coastline of about 1,100 miles long, two armed dhows is not a very significant maritime presence. But that is what we took over. And all this was for the defence of a country the size of the United Kingdom, and for the prosecution of a war in Dhofar, the southern and very rich province down the south, the size of Wales, in which the enemy, the communist-led and the communist-financed enemy, had already seized at least 9/10 of the province and was about to capture the remaining 1/10.
What was the character of this insurrection?
The insurrection in Dhofar began in 1965. And it began simply because an American oil company began prospecting in northern Dhofar for oil. And the prospect of increased revenue coming to the Sultan led the Dhofaris, whose country it was, to start asking for better conditions, a better life. Now, I must point out that the Dhofaris, these people who live in the province of Dhofar, but particularly on the hills of Dhofar, not on the coastal plain, because they're very mixed, the people live in the coastal plain, but the Jabali, the Jibal people, the mountain people, the Dhofari proper, are quite different to other Arabs in the Arabian Peninsula. They are a people that stem, it is thought, from the Horn of Africa and drifted northeastwards through Aden and up the plain through the frankincense area of the Bible. They speak quite a different language. A very fine, extremely hardy, robust people. Very different to the Omanis. And they regard each other really rather as the Highlander of Scotland regards the chaps from the south of England. Now, in their initially quite pacific search for better conditions from the Sultan, they met from Sultan's side, sadly, rebuffs. And the series of rebuffs from the Sultan, who failed to acknowledge their deserts, led them to burn, I think, two lorries belonging to this oil company. The Sultan, and I must point out that, of course, I was nowhere near the scene at this time. This is merely what I've heard and read. The Sultan, instead of saying, now, these people have burnt a few trucks, they've obviously got a grievance, I must listen to this grievance and do what I can, he took repressive measures, and he really drove people who were just trying to get a slightly better deal for themselves into a state of revolt. And a thing, an outfit was formed known as the Dhofar Liberation Army, or the Dhofar Liberation Front, which is simply these dissatisfied people trying to fight for a better deal for themselves. The Sultan, in late 65, brought down to Dhofar to help in the putting down of this very mild form of revolt the first elements of his armed forces from up north. Hitherto, there had been none there. But, of course, there is not much which a company of mixed Baluch and Arabs and not very experienced British officers who'd never been on the terrain before, and as I say, I'm talking about a province the size of Wales, can do actually to suppress an incipient revolt. Not much they could do. However, the revolt did not spread violently. It did not take on massive proportions. The situation was, to a certain extent, held. But there was a development, and the development was that the British quitted Aden. A left-wing government came into power in Aden with East European and Cuban backing, Russian presence, communist influence and so on, and of course considerable financing from the Soviet Union and from Red China. And this government took hold of all the country, which we now know as People's Democracy of Yemen, PDRI for short, the Popular Democratic Republic of Yemen, PDRI, the Popular Democratic Republic of Yemen, right up to the Dhofar frontier. And this Marxist-led government sent in hardcore communist leaders who put to death or banished the original Dhofari leaders of the Dhofar Liberation Movement and took over the leadership themselves. And come 68, the original rebellious force, which was, as I say, a group of citizens trying to win from their own sultan a better life, no longer existed. It had been taken over lock, stock and barrel by outsiders of extreme left-wing tendencies and very significantly financed and armed from the Soviet Union and Red China. And the result of all this was that during 68 and 69, the time of my predecessor in the appointment of CSAF, Corin Purton, the Sultan's forces were fighting a losing battle in Dhofar. They were on retreat continuously. And the result was that come early 1970, when I arrived on the scene, the whole of the province of Dhofar was occupied by these Dhofar rebel forces with their foreign-trained communist leaders with an armament in terms of weight of fire and range far superior to anything we had. And the only bit of Dhofar which was held by the government forces was the Royal Air Force station at Salalah, which was indispensable to us because it was from that base that our own Air Force had to fight the war, a couple of villages a bit down the coast, and the town of Salalah itself, which was wholly wired in. And because the enemy held all the mountains over which the road linking Salalah with Oman and north ran, the only way we could supply the force in Dhofar, and this force was one battalion strength stationed in the Salalah area, was either by air in very small quantities or by rowing boat over the beach during the 7 months when the Monsoon wasn't operating. And by night, the communist enemy was coming down and actually attacking the outstations, the perimeter of the Royal Air Force Station at Salalah, which we had to defend, and Salalah town and laying mines and the roads leading into it, and of course the villages Tarkham about further down the coast. I can tell you the place was in a bit of a mess.
You talked about the communist complexion of the regime in South Yemen, but was there any substance to the communism of the rebel leaders, or was it just a question of symbols?
The rebel leaders were pretty convinced communists. And they had been trained, of course, in communist institutions in Ukraine, in the Peking area and elsewhere. We knew all about this. We knew them by name, or came to know them by name. And many, of course, came over to us eventually, as I'll describe later. But, of course, the communists did suffer one very great handicap. The Jabali, the Dhofari hillmen, were, like the Omanis, by and large, strictly observing Muslims. And communism and the godless theories that they support did not go down well. And when a number of Jabali started to question certain aspects of communism, instead of being talked to quietly and convinced, they were brutally treated. And they were put to death. They had their possessions seized. They had their children taken away. They had their camels requisitioned for convoy work. They were put down. And, of course, they did not like this. And there are two major events which occurred in 1970 which saved the situation in Dhofar. And they were these. Firstly, Qaboos bin Said, that is to say the son of the Sultan, who had been educated at Sandhurst, and who after studying in England and touring bits of the world, had gone back home, was forced by his father to live in a modest house in semi-isolation some way from the palace in Salalah. And, of course, from this position, he, young Qaboos, could see what was going on in Dhofar, and he came to learn what was going on in Oman. And he decided, in the middle of 70, that the time had come when he would have to force his father to abdicate and take over the country himself. Otherwise, his father would just continue to not invest the oil money in the people's welfare, and that he would continue to drive the inhabitants, his subjects, increasingly into rebellion. And, of course, to a state where the armed forces simply couldn't cope. And, indeed, I must say to you that even in my time, many of us in the armed forces had considerable sympathy for the people who were on the opposite side. The situation in Dhofar in early 70s, as I explained to you, was really rather grim. I mean, there's no doubt the enemy, with their power and rather better leadership, would have captured the whole of Dhofar by the end of 70, unless certain events had happened. And one of these events was the change of ruler. The second event was that there was in eastern Dhofar a major argument between certain of the Muslim tribesmen and their communist masters. And this argument developed into a degree of bloodshed. And in retaliation, the communists brought in hardcore, vicious people from further west, and they put the majority of those who led this rebellion, is the wrong word, this upsurge of anti-Marxist feeling, they put it down with great ferocity and many deaths. But this, of course, started the initial feeling of revulsion against communism from which we could benefit. Because with the changed ruler and his new attitude and his obvious great popularity, he could offer terms to the Dhofaris, who were his subjects. His mother was a Dhofari. Which, provided we could get the message across them by radio, or by leaflets, or by other methods, should increasingly get them to leave the communist ranks and come to us.
Coming back to the question of communism, was there any economic program which they tried to carry out?
I think they drew up an economic program, but they never had the opportunity to put it into practice. As far as the Jabali were concerned, communism really meant the following things. Firstly, for the women, it meant liberation. And it was the female sex, above all, that tended to get the greatest benefits from the communist rule. Women were given more consideration, more responsibility. They were released from a number of burdens that they had to bear under their original way of life. And they did benefit. But for the men, it meant having their camels seized for the enemy to use for the carriage of resupply, ammunition, food and so on, up from Piedrai, from Houf, the town there, into their own lines. It meant having the children taken away for a communist indoctrination. It meant having to produce food. And it meant, for the younger men, conscription into the militia as a form of communist home guard. Inasmuch as if the armed forces of the Sultan came onto the Jebel, it was the home guard that spotted them, that watched them, that delayed them, that reported to the hardcore communist units who eventually came with a heavy armament and engaged in battle and so on. Yes, it was a significant change in their way of life. And at the beginning, of course, when they were winning, they thought it was really rather good. But after the Sultan Qaboos came to the throne, and after the uprising in the east, the communists became more worried. And, of course, the Sultan's armed forces, we ourselves, became more powerful and were able to inflict greater losses on the communists. And gradually, of course, the Jubali came to see that the Sultan was going to win, that the Sultan had far more to offer them, particularly with British help, than the communists could ever give them. But nevertheless, many months of very hard fighting had to be gone through before we could reach that happy stage. However, I'm glad to say that the PSYOPs operations, which we indulged in after the caboose came to the throne, leaflets, radio programs, and so on, worked. And whereas all the previous years since the revolt had broken out in 65, in all those years, I think only one chap had ever been taken prisoner and only about two surrendered from the communist side of the government forces. In September 70, one chap came across willingly, but by the following March, over 100 had come. And some of these were people who were officers and NCOs in the communist ranks and had been to Russia and China for training. And from these people, this trickle, 100, as I say, in the first 6 months, but when I left at the end of 72, had reached over 1,000, many of these people, plus others, were recruited by the Sultan, by us, and trained by us and the British, and formed into Firkut. That's an auxiliary force of tribesmen to fight alongside my forces in the tribal areas to win over the people and to defend them.
You said that the army became more powerful. In what way did it become more powerful?
It became more powerful because one of the first things that Sultan Qaboos did when he came to the throne was to confirm certain decisions his father had already taken. One was that a 4th Infantry Battalion, known as the Rebel Regiment, should be raised, and this was done in late 70. The Air Force was quadrupled in size. We got helicopters, we got in transport aircraft of a sort that we had never been favoured with before, Caribou, and above all the Sky Vans, which are excellent. Two sorts of helicopters. And, of course, our air power, both for transportation and for airstrikes, was massively increased. The Navy was very considerably increased in size, and all sorts of portions of the Army, which had been neglected hitherto, such as the artillery, were expanded. The artillery quickly went up from battery to regimental size. An armoured car squadron was formed. The medical services were greatly enlarged before they were primitive in the extreme. And the forces very soon, the forces which I had inherited of under 4,000 all ranks in all three services in early 70, by 1972, the end of 72, were over 10,000. But of course, this rapid expansion and fighting war simultaneously, because it was a major war down in Dhofar, put very great strains on the staff and, of course, on the defence budget. And to me, it's a miracle that the small number of British officers and the logistics staffs managed to get the additional recruits, the additional clothing, additional ammunition, and the accommodation, which is massive expansion required. But they did. And the thing that I really must say and put on record is the marvellous work for the Sultanate, which a handful of British officers did. British officers, be they on secondment or on contract. Remember that the seconded officers who went there, those below the rank of lieutenant colonel, were in fact doing jobs one rank above what they would have been doing in England. So subalterns were holding captain's appointments in the Sultan's forces, and captains were commanding companies of the rank of major. And it worked very well. And remember, too, that the brunt of the fighting fell, of course, on the infantry battalions. Now, the infantry battalions, as I said, had in their other ranks a mixture of Baluch and Arabs, very different people indeed, and speaking a different language, although, of course, both Muslim. Each rifle company of 130, 140-odd men had only got three British officers.